Stay tuned for the 293rd edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM, Prince George's Center for Excellence in the Practice of Cynicism. I don't know whether Stephen Harper has read Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, but he understands the principles she defined. She analyzed the number of coups wherein reactionary forces made massive changes during crises, changes that would have been unacceptable in placid times. We're in the midst of a worldwide financial collapse, leaving Canadians fearful for their future. Jobs are disappearing and savings diminishing. With the future looking glum and Christmas preparation diversions, Harper saw the time to strike. Behind the guise of an economic statement, he deliberately made proposals he knew would be unacceptable to the opposition parties. He rolled the dice, provoking a predictable parliamentary rebellion. The opposition bit, sparking a crisis that Harper was betting he could control. It worked so far. The rapidly cobbled coalition relied on the passive acquiescence of the Bloc Québécois, an Achilles heel that Harper knew he could exploit. Suddenly, Harper arose in righteous indignation, declaring that the democratic will of Canadians was being thwarted by a coalition embracing a party intent upon destroying our country. Total bullshit, but it's worked. Our Governor General allowed him to prorogue Parliament, thus invalidating yet another promise of our beloved Prime Minister, a vote of confidence that was supposed to take place yesterday. Very crafty, very successful. Now the Conservatives have 7 weeks to flood the airwaves and press with clever propaganda before Parliament reconvenes in January. I suppose their plan is to provoke the opposition again, perhaps driving them to an election, the one he has been looking for that could give him his majority. Already polls show Harper's popularity rising from the mid-30% range to 44%. If this holds through an election, Conservatives will take a majority of seats, and Harper will have the power he covets to change Canada forever. At one time, a candid Conservative politician said that they would make our country unrecognizable. Behind this crisis, he may have his wish. Harper's manipulation of public opinion would not have been possible if Canadian voters were well informed. We are not. Our ignorance will be the end of progressive government in our nation. We betrayed our heritage through inattention and laziness. The other day I was running around Prince George as the coalition was forming and the whole of Canadian politics was in flux. I couldn't help talking about it with anyone I met. The first person I tried this on was a retail clerk who had no idea what was unfolding. When I mentioned Harper, I got the impression she thought I was talking about a musician. The second person was another one in retail service. She apologized for her ignorance of current events, but family and work precluded her attention to politics. I happen to have encountered a couple of examples of the class of people who respond to political advertising of all stripes. Harper's Conservatives are pandering to these folks who are vulnerable to their baseless lies and clever spin. Fortunately, the decision as to the fate of the coalition is not in the hands of know-nothings, but of our worthy leaders. Seriously, the sooner both Harper and Dion are dumped by their respective parties, the better off Canada will be. As financial crisis ripples around the world, the so-called Liberal government of British Columbia claims we are immune. Our official unemployment rate actually fell last month, a figure that may have included some fudging or been out of date. We're riding on a tide of construction, although most of it is Olympics-based. Our new license plates, if you pay the fee to display one, claims that we are the best place on earth, a breathtaking opinion. If we're doing so damned well, how is it we have the highest rate of child poverty in Canada? Much was made of a jettisoned program that would have extended full-day kindergarten to children as young as three. Considering that children living in poverty in our great province are the most likely to be unprepared for grade one, and thus handicapped right at the starting gate, this was a bad choice of programs to cut, but cut it they did. Well, we have a fortnight's Olympic party to finance, so we can't take care of every little kid, can we? When Harper's Conservatives won their minority government in 2006, David Emerson jumped the Liberal ship to join the new crew. His first job was to continue negotiations toward a softwood lumber agreement with our southern neighbors. Funny thing, but most Canadians thought we already had a free trade agreement in place, but I guess there's free trade and there is, well, free trade. Emerson, the turncoat, soon capitulated to American demands, and Harper trumpeted that he had achieved what Paul Martin could not. He had secured peace in the lumber industry that would hold for years. Right. From the get-go, the Americans undermined whatever rights we had left to export our lumber without hindrance. Fees were added to our exports in the name of homeland security, while busybodies inspected shipments to assure that there were no terrorist boards included. American producers filed harassing complaints and lawsuits. Now we find that the very terms of Emerson's capitulation have hamstrung our industry. Our government is forced to charge producers an export tax, adding to the cost of our lumber, taxes that total $500 million so far. With governments coming to the aid of capitalist industry worldwide, we find that Emerson's baby prohibits any aid to our softwood lumber producers. We're hamstrung, hoist by our own petard in the rush by Harper to claim a victory that eluded his predecessor. It appears that the liberals failed to achieve an agreement with the U.S. for good reasons. They wouldn't sacrifice the rights of Canada's industry as willingly as Harper did. A reassuring report called Global Trends, a product of no less than 16 American intelligence agencies, tell us that the influence of Al-Qaeda is waning. How comforting. Soon the comedy of nations will be a reality and we will all live as a happy international family. I wonder where I can buy some of that stuff they've been smoking. We might note that martyrs to the Islamist cause are still promised an immediate pass to paradise and a plague of virgins as a reward for offing infidels. Not just that, but I learned that some have been assured 70 free passes to paradise for nominees of their choice, assuring that they can import all of their friends and relatives without customs and immigration formalities. I can imagine a certain amount of hostility on the part of a wife, or wives, so elevated when confronted by the gaggles of giggling virgins, but that's paradise's problem. As long as religions, and I exclude none, promise their faithful eternal rewards or punishments after death, we will never confront the fact that we have to get along together with our only earthly chance of happy longevity. General Motors is cutting to the bone to rationalize their plea to tap the public treasuries of Canada and the United States. They've even cast Tiger Woods to the dogs with their cuts. No longer will he receive $7 million a year from GM to pimp their products. Poor Tiger, watch for him on the breadlines. Did anyone ever buy an overpriced GM vehicle on the strength of the endorsement of a man who earns his bread, aside from the corporation's stipend, by knocking small balls around vast lawns? Ted Gistaro, billed as a senior U.S. analyst of terrorist threats, identified one of the biggest threats to American security. Hold on for this. Canadian passport holders. No wonder we're hassled at the borders. We are a nation of terrorists, easily identified by the maple leaf on our passports. What he actually targeted in his comments is those we accept as immigrants, then as citizens, who buzz off to join Al-Qaeda and their ilk, causing mayhem behind the shield of Canadian citizenship. He has a point there. For too long, we've allowed immigrants to take Canadian citizenship and then take up residence overseas, only using their precious citizenship when it is to their advantage. Once granted Canadian citizenship, there are no strings on what we may do or where we may reside. Other nations are not so generous or lax. American citizens, no matter where they live, must file annual income tax returns. Many do not, but if they demand the services of the United States government later on, they can always be required to prove that they have followed this obligation. It would be reasonable to require of Canadian citizens of dual citizenship living overseas that they maintain reasonable ties with this country and not just when they need help. Back when Lebanon last exploded, we were surprised at the number of Canadians who came forth demanding that our government save them. Where were all of these people, and how had they suddenly come out of the woodwork in their hour of need? How many were native Lebanese who had lived here for a while, taken citizenship, then returned to their homeland? If they had no ties here nor intention to return, were they really Canadian? This is a question that should be taken up seriously by an assiduous future government. Democracy elevates superior individuals to power. This is axiomatic. The voting public sees through electioneering, hype, and propaganda to choose their leaders wisely. Believe that, and I have some choice pieces of Afghan farmland to sell you. Silvio Berlusconi bought election as leader of Democratic Italy with his billions and his control of the nation's major television stations. But that's Italy, right? So who is mayor of New York? perhaps the richest man in the city, Michael Bloomberg, a billionaire several times over. He's held the office for 2 terms, the legal limit. Not satisfied by this, he's pushing for a rule change allowing him to run for a 3rd term. His argument is that New York, in this time of market chaos, requires his expertise. Sounds like Vladimir Putin. Doug Muzio, a professor at a New York college, stated, "This is a third world country. I hate to sound like a Marxist about this, but you've got the socioeconomic elite coming together and pushing a 3rd term. How could this happen in a country where talent, unadulterated by influence, fraud, or money, elevated a man like George Wanker Bush to the presidency? Ours is a civilization of laws, not men. This is supposed to be the backbone of our society. Billionaires, or mere millionaires, cannot buy exemption from the laws. Look at Martha Stewart and Conrad Black. Don't look at the likes of Berlusconi or either Bush. The exemption proves the rule. When it comes to contract law, a deal is a deal. Sign a contract with a bank and you adhere to your obligations, or else. Whether the bank has a reciprocal obligation is another matter. Now things are taking a different turn. With the current economic turmoil, courts are becoming pragmatic in their interpretation of contracts. Economic realities are trumping legal rights. At this point, let me stress that this applies only to the big guys, not you and your conflict with Visa or MasterCard. Wachovia Group had a takeover agreement with Citibank that it broke to take a better offer by Wells Fargo. Their defense? The agreement was not valid under the circumstances. It convinced a judge. If you are too big to fail, no law or agreement is final in constraining you. Now, how many of us are big enough to be able to bug out of our contracts under the circumstances? A small blurb in the Guardian Weekly reports that Britain will spend $1.2 billion in aid to India, where 828 million people subsist on less than $2 a day. It goes on to mention, without further comment, that India is a nuclear-armed state and has sent a spacecraft to the moon. Well, tut, tut. But before we examine the moat in our neighbor's eyes, we might ask why our province has multi-millions available to sponsor the 2010 Olympic Party when we have Canada's highest child poverty rate, or why Prince George has homeless people lined up for food at St. Vincent de Paul on 2nd Avenue and seeking shelter in the doorways of a $3 million publicly funded garage at a defunct gambling hall, or why our nation can send thousands of men to Afghanistan to fight a war begun by a discredited U.S. president while many of our First Nations reserves haven't clean drinking water, nor why the developed nations of this world have trillions of dollars to rescue our financial sector from its own follies while millions of people are jobless and desperate in the very shadows of the marbled facades of our banks. Maude Barlow, head of the Council of Canadians and tireless campaigner for citizen rights to water, has been appointed as the United Nations' first advisor on water issues. Our Prime Minister has celebrated this appointment by announcing that Canada will abandon a database monitoring freshwater supplies around the world. For 30 years, Environment Canada has maintained these records, but a spokesman for Harper's Environment Canada says the global environment monitoring system is no longer a priority. We have performed this task for 3 decades, but now, as access to clean water is more important than ever, we have other priorities. Experts warn that future wars will likely be fought over water, yet Harper has other priorities. We know from today's battle over Parliament that Harper's overriding priority is a majority in the House so he can mold Canada in his image of a corporate-run state where the only rule is the devil take the hindmost. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Hot shots from the former Big Three auto companies were chastised for flying to Washington in private jets to beg for public rescue from their follies, like chartering jet planes while their companies crank out unwanted monster vehicles. They returned for their next try in fuel-efficient vehicles with enlarged demands and threats of chaos if money is not shoveled into the maw of their dinosaur companies. Meanwhile, it's reported that Stephen Harper missed the opening of a new Toyota plant in Ontario. Funny thing that the Japanese can make vehicles people want and profit from it. In the interest of disclosure, my wife and I own 2 Toyotas, one 22 years old, and we've just given away a car that we could not sell. That car was the product of a company that is now a Ford subsidiary. But I digress. Those companies are not just begging in Washington. General Motors also has demands of Ottawa, threatening to move production from Canada's plants if not bribed. Australia is dumping $2.3 billion U.S. into its private auto companies, most subsidiaries of the Big Three. I don't know what other nations are doling out in subsidies to induce their vehicle producers not to pull up stakes, but the total should be mind-boggling. Too bad that Canada hasn't a government that would tell domestic builders they're on their own to make a profit or bugger off. Meanwhile, we could establish a crown corporation to design and build a truly Canadian hybrid car, a basic, rugged, rust-resistant, all-wheel drive vehicle suitable for the environment. I would be the first in line to buy one. I've been looking at a replacement for that 22-year-old Toyota truck, and I cannot find a satisfactory one. Since that truck has given us such good service, I went first to Toyota looking for a similar one. That old truck is a simple four-wheel drive, four-cylinder vehicle. It came with a plain bench seat cab. No radio, no air conditioning, and to my wife's chagrin, no power steering. Toyota now boasts standard equipment including an extended cab, air conditioning, fancy stereo system, bucket seats, cup holders, and the mandatory sunglass holder. I've written to Toyota Canada asking about obtaining a basic vehicle. No answer. I've appealed to the local dealer. Tough luck. I've looked at the Ford Ranger and find that it's not comparable to Toyota quality, and their basic truck includes, in addition to the junk on the Toyota, satellite radio, like it or not. When I worked for a summer on a Ford truck assembly line, we built trucks to customer order. Buyers specified what they wanted, and we built them as requested. No radio, no problem. No air conditioning, not available. Now it seems that all companies have standard packages, take them or leave them. No wonder they're having trouble selling their product. When I go shopping for bread, I don't want to be offered cake. Not when they have that cake has a 30 grand price tag. Surprise, surprise, the American-installed government of Iraq is auctioning off rights to develop their oil fields, a right that used to be jealously guarded for domestic benefit. Even Saddam Hussein would not allow foreigners to exploit the public's petroleum resources. Say, you don't suppose that his stubborn insistence on keeping the U.S. majors out of Iraq had anything to do with the American invasion and occupation? Of course not. To imply such is to be branded a conspiracy theorist. Everyone knows that Bush attacked Iraq because Hussein threatened to blow up Washington with his weapons of mass destruction. The Wall Street Journal trumpeted the opening of 6 oil fields and 2 natural gas fields to exploitation by foreign oil corporations. The Iraqi oil minister met with representatives of 35 oil companies laying out terms for bidding on 20-year service contracts. The director general of their oil ministry proudly stated, "This is a very important milestone in the history of the Iraqi oil industry." You bet your bippy it's an important milestone, important in that this represents the fruits of billions of dollars spent and hundreds of thousands of murdered in Iraq by the coalition of the killing. The Western public paid for the war in dollars and bodies, while Iraq paid with a destroyed infrastructure and many times more deaths, all in the interest of allowing oil corporations to rip off Iraqi assets. What a shameful operation this has been. One rationale for governments dumping trillions of dollars into the hands of private corporations is to prevent the dreaded deflation. Gods forbid that the money in my pocket should buy more in the future, but never mind. I see the first sign of deflation not in the economy, where temporary oil declines are reflected, albeit slowly, at the gasoline pumps. I refer to body counts. Last week, another 3 Canadian soldiers died in Afghanistan. Odd, but I seem to recall not long ago that the total Canadian casualties, although there's nothing casual about death, were announced to be 1 diplomat and 100 soldiers. It appears that deflation affected this 100, driving it down to 97, so that these 3 deaths raised it to 100 again. This tally of 100 was announced without qualms by the CBC. No one has pointed out this discrepancy. How did the Harper regime pass this off on us, and why? I suppose they've redefined death, perhaps by excluding those slaughtered by reckless American jet jockeys. They aren't dead, they just succumbed to friendly fire, as more Canadians die in this stupid war that is not a war, but a mission, will we find the total of 100 reached again as more forceful departures of soldiers from this mortal coil are excluded from official body counts? Harper promised that his old, new government of Canada will not engage in a fire sale of Crown assets in his attempt to prevent a budget deficit. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty made the offhand comment that they might sell the CN Tower, but afterwards said that was a joke. Flaherty specifically ruled out selling the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. That was a promise. Uh-oh. So I suppose we can kiss our public radio station goodbye when and if the Conservatives win their coveted majority. Would you buy a new car from a company that could be facing bankruptcy? This is the choice facing anyone looking to buy any of the brands of Chrysler, General Motors, or Ford. When a company seeks bankruptcy protection, all of its assets and liabilities are on the table for the courts to sort out. Union contracts can be rewritten, bonds liquidated, and stocks might be declared worthless when debts exceed assets. Warranties are liabilities, promises to product owners that certain repairs will be performed by the company. If the company is not there, neither is the obligation. Fini. I heard one analyst claim that the honoring of warranties would never be a problem as those obligations could be sold to an outfit like Canadian Tire, which would assume them. Odd it is that anyone would buy a debt, but I do see that possibility under one circumstance. It would be valuable to an unscrupulous buyer, which could use the repairs covered to piggyback others that are not covered, charging the captive customer. In fact, under no other set of assumptions would this package of obligations be worth anything. If it were, those millions of outstanding warranties would be carried on the asset side of the troubled company's ledgers. I, for one, would not touch a Big Three product with a barge pole, as there would not even be the assurance that replacement parts would continue to be available. This reluctance to buy on the part of a huge part of the marketplace might be the straw that drives one or more of those companies down the tubes, regardless of how much public money we throw at them. I don't want to be considered suspicious when it comes to the sudden drop of crude oil prices by a full two-thirds in less than a year, but there seems to be an interesting cast of winners and losers. The big winners are Western nations, whose thirst for others' oil is insatiable. The losers are a host of producing countries which had shown signs of becoming uppity. Just at a time when the developed countries have been attempting to increase consumer spending, along came relief in the form of lower gasoline and heating fuel prices. Countries which were flexing their economic muscle are being rapidly brought to heel. Saudi Arabia, Russia, Venezuela, and Ecuador all come to mind. All of them are hurting, and Uncle Sam, for one, doesn't mind that a bit. Collateral damage is felt in Alberta, but who outside of Canada gives a hoot for that place? And there might just be a bit of interest in knocking that province in line. Plans for bitumen upgraders in Alberta have been shelved, upgraders that would have made Canada independent of American refineries, perhaps giving Canada illusions of energy independence. I don't see how a massive market like petroleum could be so clandestinely manipulated by any power, but the evidence makes me wonder. The National Cheer Safety Foundation wants to see American federal regulation of cheerleading, since they claim that nearly 30,000 cheerleaders a year are treated for injuries in the U.S. I know this sounds like more Uncle Don bullshit, but I got it from the Globe and Mail, and that was not the 1st of April edition. There are few supporters of Stéphane Dion anymore outside of his immediate family. I may have been one of the last holdouts, as I am a charter member of the Anyone But Harper Brigade. Maybe the last bit of my faith in Dion ebbed away when I read the following quote from him regarding the fiscal crisis. "We have other plans, other proposals. If we have to help the banking system, if there are problems with the rest of the world that affect us. But I think we're in a better position than others. I am an optimist, but I think I am also a realist." How can a reasonable person today be both a realist and an optimist? Come on, Stefan, give your head a shake. Is it not odd that the world's attention has been diverted from piracy on Wall and Bay Streets to piracy of the seeds off Somalia? Since that land became a failed state, there's been piracy in their waters, but no one cared much except Somalis. With no effective government and navy to protect this sea, foreign trawlers have swept in, stealing their fish resources to the tune of an estimated $100 million. This left native fishermen without a livelihood until they discovered the rich catches above the waterline in the form of foreign vessels carrying valuable cargoes. Before we roundly condemn the Somali pirates as criminals and terrorists, we might well check out what drove them to corral the only resources left to them. I know this is not the way of the day. Instead, we'll bomb the bejesus out of their villages, sink their ships, and shoot the men who attack shipping. It's not our style to look at causes, but rather to go after the effects, much as we treat terrorism as a cause rather than an effect of our policies. In this, I am a realist and a pessimist. All we hear in the news today is more soldiers killed in Afghanistan, Harper's mess in Ottawa, and the fiscal mess everywhere. Sure, these are important, but what goes on with these events squeezed out of the news headlines? More is being revealed about how our former prime minister, the one with the chin, took bribes from Karl-Heinz Schreiber funneled from Airbus for his throwing Air Canada business to them. Think he didn't take a bribe? How else does one explain $1,000 bills handed over in anonymous hotel rooms? No legitimate business is conducted this way. And where is the news of Canada's complicity in the abuse and torture of prisoners in Afghanistan? This should be at the top of the news, as proof would mean that high military and civilian officials could be open to charges of war crimes. Under international law, they would be vulnerable to prosecution in any jurisdiction on the planet. We might see the day when Canadian big shots would be in the position of the late General Pinochet, afraid to go beyond our borders for fear of being apprehended and tried for those war crimes. A shameful footnote to this accusation of torture is that our Justice Department's attempts to discredit one Canadian, whose name I will not attempt to pronounce, sent to Syria in an extraordinary rendition. They claim he actually mutilated himself. Damn clever of these awful terrorists to beat and abuse themselves when their tender keepers aren't watching. As for me, I'd like to see the day when this crew of officials, liberal and conservative, diplomatic and military, are brought to justice. In a civilized world, torture is not acceptable under any circumstances, Jack Bauer's 24, notwithstanding. This concludes the 293rd opening of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. An old person is one who remembers when refrigerators were rounded and cars were square.